Frustration is there. Most people cannot handle freedom in the employment situation. We need schedules. We need a time to start and a time to end. We need some rules. We need a rule as to how much lunch a person takes. We need a rule as to how much time one ought to work. Now that confines us, but most of us need it. And I tend to put it on myself. But some people don't like to have those kinds of rules. We say, but gee, in some kind of a spiritual situation, we shouldn't have those rules. Don't you trust me? See, you know, that kind of an idea. Well, you know, people are people. And we're all built differently. And I find that most people need structure to function well. Then the other problem is lack of measurement. Who really measures whether we're doing well? One of the questions that came in said, how do I know when I'm doing okay? You know, nobody ever evaluates me. I want to know if I'm doing my job well, and I have some comments on that later on in the question and answer time. So lack of measurement. In other words, who am I doing okay? Now, theoretically, we say only God is my judge. No human ought to evaluate me for my ministry. But internally, we want to know, we want someone to say, hey, you're doing okay. Now, the problem is that there's a lack of measurement, but then there's also, I find in the Christian situation, a resentment toward measurement. And so it goes both ways. You know, it's, am I doing okay? And then right on the other hand, but what right do you have to tell me that I'm not doing okay? Do you see the dilemma we find there? And I'm just sharing it as a problem, I believe, in the NAV ministries. The other issue is the problem of promotion or approval. And I'll get into that more in ambition and ability. So that's some peculiarities of being involved in the NAVs. Now, being involved in an administrative or support staff has some of the same kinds of thoughts behind it, but it's structured a bit differently. Okay, let's talk about what some solutions could be. I use the little term, the RX, you know, the prescription. Well, first of all, I think we need to have our view of God tested. Philippians 4, 11 through 13. And I believe that we need to recognize that God is a sovereign, loving God. He will never allow you to be in a circumstance that He has not ordained. Now, if that one little statement can be put to practice and say, God, I'm here and you put me here. Now, my mouth got me into this problem, but I'm still here and I am here by your appointment. Therefore, I can survive this. And God, and you will use it for your best. So I believe a view of God is very important. And this has to do with our spiritual roots that go in deeply, such that we don't blame people, but we look to God and look to Him for answers in these areas. The second thing, and Carlo, this is where I get into your issue, is self-perception. In Romans 12:3, it talks about having a sane estimate of yourself, a sane view. Now, Mary and I have had a lot of discussions over the years regarding my capacity. In fact, we've had some good arguments about it. And she said for years, she said she was going about saying to herself, what's wrong with me? You know, why can't I keep up with Jerry? Why can't I do the schedule that he seems to keep? She said, then one day it dawned on me that it was Jerry who was abnormal, not her. And that really helped. And what it really dawned is we have very different capacities for certain kinds of things. See, some people have a high capacity for relationships and others have a low capacity for relationships. Others have a high capacity for work but a very low capacity for interpersonal relationships. That's why some people in the kind of jobs they select work individually in a cubicle much better than they do out selling or managing people. See, we need to recognize how we are personally built. The fact is that God has given us certain kinds of abilities. God has given us certain kinds of capacities. God has sovereignly placed you in a certain kind of family. I mean, most of you, if we sit down and talk, and I am no psychoanalyst by any means, but if we talk through your family background, you would find out very quickly that there are some things that you're doing today that are a direct result of that. I was chatting with a guy recently, and he had a problem with just having an angry spirit. And I asked what had happened to him early in his life, that, what's the first hurt he can remember? And he had it immediately. I said, that's easy. So when I was 4 years old, my father backed out over one of my tricycles that I'd left behind the car, and the whole family was in the car, and he said, instead of stopping, he just kept backing up. It had hooked underneath, and he just drug it for 6 blocks down the road, chewing me out and saying, I told you never to leave it there again, and you'll never have another tricycle. And he said, I didn't. Now that has had an impact on his life. See? And all of us could probably go back and say, there's some things that happened. But folks, God is sovereign. See? God placed you in that family. God was in control of your upbringing. God was in control there. And so the abilities, the emotional capacity you have, the fundamental person that you are, is of God's plan. Our task is to figure it out and find out. Now, please don't put too much stock in these tests, okay? But I included them just for fun for you. And when you want to take them sometime, you can just see. And that's what those are. Self-discovery tests. In no way do I vouch for their validity. So don't put too much in them, but have some fun doing them and learn some things about yourself, okay? That's the main thing that I put those in for. So, Carla, that's the issue of capacities. But we have to discover our capacities. And you do it largely by trial and error. Now, I ran into someone in a mission... Excuse me, I'll be right with you, Martin. In a missionary situation recently where this person had... And it was a girl... had watched a friend of hers go through stress burnout. And as a result, she was so incredibly protective of every aspect of her life for fear that she would burn out because she'd seen her friend go through this. Well, that was too much of a fixation and self-protection. Well, I won't do this, and I've got to get all my sleep, and I'm not going to do this. You can become so self-protective that you never learn the limits of your capacities. Now, of course, when you've pushed them over several times, then you've got a different ball game for yourself. You've got to learn your lessons. Mary has learned her lesson on a couple issues. And we as a family looked at it. By the way, there's not just the capacity of the individual, but there's also the capacity of the couple. And then later there will be the capacity of the family. For instance, if there's a child in a family that's really having some difficulties, well, there may be different ways that you have to handle the whole of how you have people in to your home. Martin?
I just don't know the quotation you had about having a same view to yourself.
Romans 12:3. That's the Phillips translation, I believe, of that. Is that correct? Does someone remember that? Let me just check to be sure. I believe that's the Phillips translation of Romans 12:3, where it says, for though through the grace given to me, I say to every man among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but think so as to have sound judgment. See? And then in the Phillips translation, it says, have a sane estimate of yourself. It's a good verse. Okay, let's go to a next item here, and I'm going a little longer on this one, but we're still in good time. I think we need to learn to change our responses to stress. Folks, I have thought this one over a great deal. And I've decided that I don't need to become angry at certain things. And I don't need to say certain things. I can change my response by a decision of my will. Now, I can't change that initial, just the immediate response. Do you see what I mean? The thing that just pops into my gut, so to speak, to my stomach, or my mind, but what I can change is what I do with it. It is possible to decide not to be mad. It can be done. And it is possible to say that I am not going to respond in a certain way. And I think that is the issue of Philippians 4, 5 through 8, that passage that we read, where it says, let your mind dwell on these things. That's a decision of the will. Psalm 39, 1 through 6 is another passage that you can jot down. Yeah, he said, David said, I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle while the wicked are in my presence. Then verse 3 he says, my heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue, Lord, make me to know my end and what is the extent of my days. Let me know how transient I am. Behold, thou hast made my days as handbreadth. And see, what David did, he handled that inner anger that he had. And he handled it both by his focus on God and his frailty and by a decision of his will to keep his mouth shut. At least that's how I interpret Psalm 39. Yeah. Psalm 39, 1 to 6. Now, personally, this is something, and it's a little out of order. You're going to get a little out of order here, but that's all right. I think we need to recognize our stress stimulants. If you want to put it in your outline, that's number 6 in your outline. If you want to just jot it down there. You know, an alcoholic does not go into a tavern to have a Coke. He just knows better not to. And there are certain circumstances that you know put you under stress. Overscheduling, saying yes to too many things, not being willing to tell your boss that when you will really be able to get that done, or having a misunderstanding, he expects it at 5 o'clock and you're not going to do it till next Tuesday. And a matter of communication. See, there are certain stress stimulants. It's kind of like I have stopped drinking caffeinated coffee. Now, caffeine doesn't bother me in the slightest in terms of keeping me awake or making me nervous, but I found out through some experimentation that it affected something relating to my throat. Through some little injury I must have done when I was singing one time about 3 or 4 years ago. So, I just don't drink it. Unless down in Brazil, they serve this thick stuff that just about goes right straight to your big toe. But interestingly enough, it had very little caffeine in it. It didn't affect me very much. But anyhow, I just say, well, that's a stimulant that affects me, so I won't do it. Okay, there are certain situations that you get yourself into that you say, hey, I know if I get in that situation, I'm going to be stressed out. So you learn where some of those weak areas are. And you just say, I'm going to not engage in those. Now, I'd like to also mention the issue of friendships. I believe that friendships are one of the greatest things that can help us withstand stress. Every one of us needs someone with whom we can share our hearts. And I call it redemptive friendships. Friendships that build you up instead of tear you down. Have you seen the difference? Have you been with some people and you just wish they'd go away? I mean, they're friends and they're Christians and they're nice people, and I'm sure other people like them. But for me, it drains me instead of builds me up. We need what I call these redemptive friendships. We need the ability to share. Then I would like to talk about the big three. The big three. How do you like that for a title on this? And that is, rest is the first thing. All of us need an appropriate amount of rest. Psalm 42:8. Psalm 42:8. And Psalm 127:2. In fact, I was going to share my quiet time with you this morning. And then I didn't at the beginning. I thought of starting it with just sharing that, but I noticed it's in my notes. And this morning I had my quiet time in Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Unless the Lord guards the city, the watchman keeps awake in vain. Verse 2. It is vain for you to rise up early and to retire late, to eat the bread of painful labor, for he gives to his beloved even in sleep. I think part of that application is that we must protect ourselves to get the appropriate amount of rest. I get frequently asked, Jerry, how do you get so much done? And I don't want to blow my own horn on that, but I know I can get a number of things done. They said, you must only sleep 4 or 5 hours. And that's not true at all. I shoot for 8 hours of sleep a night, personally. Now, I can get by on 6 for a period of time. It's just that I get become, you know, I don't like people anymore. As long as I'm only working with things, I can do with less sleep. But if I'm going to be around people, not for me. And I have personally found that I always shoot for between 7 and 8 hours. I personally found I need it. And it's interesting, and you ladies will love this. J. Oswald Sanders made a comment to us at our staff conference in the Pacific region about 3 or 4 years ago. And when he said this, the women just breathed a sigh of relief and the men's mouths just dropped straight down, unhinged their jaws. And that was, he says, on the average, that a woman needs 1 hour of sleep a night more than men. Now that was an interesting statement. And he said, you know, he led a mission that was 2/3 women, China Inland Mission. Now the Overseas Missionary Fellowship. And it's for terms of stress. For one thing, I don't know any mother who ever gets a decent night's sleep because they're always on the edge of sort of listening. And now, in fact, I've had that experience when Mary has been gone and I've taken care of the kids. I thought, how does this woman ever sleep? You know, because you're always listening. You're just sort of on edge. But in general, women need more rest than men. So that's just a thought. But everybody needs rest. Secondly, we all need some kind of recreation, relaxation, and exercise. I have a very simple definition of recreation. People have asked me many times, what do you do for recreation? And then I tell them, and they said, that's not recreation. I said, why would you write a book on your vacation? Or why would you do this? That doesn't click. Recreation, in my mind, is what you choose to do that you are not required to do. And that's a simple definition. It's when you choose what you are doing that you are not required to do. That to me is recreation. Now see, I have to mow my lawn. That is not recreation. Now some people taking care of flowers in the garden is recreation. For me, it would not be. For some people, having to write anything would not be recreation. Now if I had to do it, you know, if NAPRES came and said, you've got this assignment, then it would probably cease to be recreation for me. You know, so those of you who are doing it for a job, it's not recreation. So that's how I define it. Now you also need exercise, which is a different thing. So recreation isn't just goofing off, but it's doing that which refreshes you. By the way, I want to just make a comment on television that it's rare that television is ever recreation. Recreation needs mental involvement, and it's rare that recreation can ever be passive. Now, a limited amount is okay. Television is more like amusement. A means not in the Latin prefix. Muse means think, so not think. That's amusement. Whereas recreation is recreate. So it has to involve an active involvement of your mind and or body. And the third thing has to do with balance and pacing. That somehow we need to learn in eat, work, and sleep to come to a point of balance. Now, I believe that people can go out of balance for periods of time. For instance, in the summer of 1969, I took 2 months from the beginning of July till the end of August, and I did one thing constantly. All I did was this one thing and slept and ate. That was all there was. I mean, a quiet time, but nothing else. And it was to work on my dissertation. I needed to get it done, and I put in virtually constant 7 days a week, straight through, and often through the night, because it was a push that due to when the computer was available at the Air Force Academy is part of what. That's why I had to work all night sometimes. And I just set aside that time and went full bore, 100% of everything I had for that period of time. That's not very balanced. But you can do it for a limited period of time. Now, I have found in work situations, someone says, well, boy, my boss wants us to work 7 days a week and 12 hours a day. And I say, that's fine. That's what you're paid for. You know, that's, you know, you're his salaried employee who is there and being paid a pretty high salary as an engineer. I said, that's really what you're being paid for. Now, the issue is for how long? You know, if the company has a massive push on something, all the employees need to get behind and do it. I don't know of any other way to do it, and I have no problem. And we've had many Christians in our ministries who've been caught in that at high ministry times. They're just working night and day. But you can do it for a month or 2 months. But going on for 3 and 4 and 5, I said, now if that's the case, I think you need to quit the job. Or you need to alter it. You need to do something that's different. You can't live like that all the time. See, when I did that, and I've done it more than once, I had a specific starting time, a specific goal, and I counted the cost knowing that I wasn't going to be able to do other things during that period of time. So I don't want you to think that balance and pacing means that I'm always having this wonderful, idyllic, balanced life. It means to push, relax, change, and develop. So it's a fluid thing, but over a period of months, there's got to be balance. Does that make sense to you? I mean, do you know, how many of you have been in companies, you know, maybe many of you haven't worked, but have you been in companies where you've had a big hard push for a project? The navigators, I know that, yeah. Well, you know, we just do it. And it's just that when it does it all the time, then that's a problem. Then you've got to change the system. Another thing that's very important is for relieving stress, we need to have a plan to reduce stress points, to respond differently, and to retrain our thinking about stress. And I think finally we need to say, do I see an end in sight to the stress patterns that I'm in? Now I'm not going to go through much of this conclusion. It's on here. You can see Psalm 42 and some solutions. I'd like to just finally say what I've written out here. The stress is real. Our responses are real, and we can't deny the effect in our lives. But stress is controllable by our decisions, and it's bearable through our roots in God. Each person has a different capacity, and most of us put stress on ourselves by our thinking and our internal pressure rather than what comes from outside. So that's what I would like to conclude with. And just to have you think about it, I wrote it out so that it's there clearly for you, and so you can meditate on that a bit. I tell you what I think. Do you have any immediate questions? I'm just looking at our time, and we'll end up right at 12. Any questions? Yes.
I have two questions on capacity. Is it possible to increase your capacity at stress?
Yes, it is impossible. It is possible, just like it's impossible to increase your muscles. Your capacity can be expanded, but the key is gradually. You know, I can't just go down and grab this big weight. You know, I pull like this and my feet would go up instead of, you know, but after working a while, you know, with the weight, you build into it. So what you do is you gradually stretch and you develop it. And it has to do partially with how you organize your thinking and yourself. And so, yeah, I can see capacity being stretched significantly by sometimes small changes being made in a person's life pattern. So, for instance, if you're a perfectionist, if you can just cut some of the edge off your perfectionism, you'll increase your capacity probably by 50%, you know, very soon. If you can live with some undone tasks, that'll increase your capacity.
How do you train yourself to do that?
Well, I think it's very difficult to do it. It's a decision of the will. It has to do partially with their value system. For instance, do you feel, as a Christian, that God somehow demands of you that you do things perfectly? So that becomes a theological issue. If you recognize that it is not a spiritual issue, and that in reality not everything has to be done perfectly, then that'll start to relieve your mind, but it's a thinking process that you have to go through. You have to reason your way through it and then practice it and break some habits. It's in a sense, perfectionism is in a sense like a tender conscience. If I don't do it perfectly, then I feel guilty. So in a sense, you have to sear that aspect of your conscience. Now you can't you can't do that to an extensive. You're never going to be, if you're a perfectionist, you're never going to be a person who doesn't have some of those tendencies, and it's not a bad tendency. Those people are very important for doing certain kinds of things. They will keep slobs like me in order, for instance, you know, and they'll really help out a lot. But you can take the edge off it, because it can really affect you emotionally if it becomes almost a spiritual issue.
We often have different needs for recreation, like from mouth to time. And also, when you mention recreation, I know rest is every night you can rest, but recreation, do we need a little bit every day, or
no, it's recreation. You might need a little every day, like in some reading or just a time, a quiet time to think or a walk or something. I think you need periodic breaks. That's why I think weekends are good. I think God made us to take some time off. And I believe we need something every few months where we just have a break, you know, a day that's a change of pace. And I think we need a pattern that we do set up for ourselves. I have a pattern that I have set up for myself that has to do with most with exercise, which I happen to combine something that not only is exercise, that I enjoy very much. You can do exercise and it not be recreation. You know, it just simply, you know, it's kind of like eating food you don't like. You know, it's good for you, but, you know, it's that. So that would be how I would think on that. Okay, let's take about a 10-minute break. Let's come back. I remember when I was working on my PhD, the guy that was on my committee, he says, well, the name of the game is you climb up and pull the ladder up with you. In other words, so no one else, make it tough for everybody else to get it. Someone else says you claw your way to the top, even if it means stepping on someone's head. And those kinds of attitudes are not very pleasing to us as a Christian particularly. There was a story of a little kid he was in health class, you know, about second or third grade. And in the health class, the teacher asked what each of the kids did to take care of their teeth. This one little kid raised his hands and he says, I watch out for people who shove at the water fountains. Now, someone will have to explain to someone who push, you know, to hit their teeth. Well, a lot of us go through life watching out for people who shove at the water fountains. But you know, there's the other side of it we don't like too well either. Have you ever seen this cartoon that was called High and Thirsty? Any of you seen that? And the picture is this neighbor of High is a guy, his name is Thirsty, and he sits over there with his lawn about this high and his whole house all disheveled, and he's sitting there with a bottle of beer sticking on his big belly and doing nothing. I mean, totally ambitionless. Lazy, no goals, nothing else. And Archie Bunker without the cutting edge, if you want to think back on that television series. Just nothing. Now, what's interesting is we despise the ambitious person and we despise the person who has no ambition. Isn't that true? We don't like either one. I had a quote I'd like to read to you. It was Herbert Hoover, former president of the United States many years ago. And he, by the way, wrote a lot of things that were very perceptive. Whether people liked him as a president or not is another thing. He says, in my opinion, we are in danger of developing a cult of the common man, which means a cult of mediocrity. Let us remember that the great human advances have not been brought about by mediocre men and women. They were brought about by distinctly uncommon people with vital sparks of leadership. Many great leaders were of humble origin, but that alone was not their greatness. It is a curious fact that when you get sick, you want an uncommon doctor. If your car breaks down, you want an uncommonly good mechanic. When we get into war, we want a dreadfully uncommon admiral and an uncommon general. I have never met a father and mother who did not want their children to grow up to be uncommon men and women. May it always be so, for the future rests not in mediocrity, but in the constant renewal of leadership in every phase of our national life. Is it wrong to want to be the president of a company? No, it's not wrong. But why do you want to be president of a company? Is it to be known as being president of a company? Or is it to serve using the abilities to the maximum? So what we want to deal with today is, what is the issue of ambition and ability? Now, in the Navigators, there are some peculiar variations of this. There have been various people who have felt in the Navigators that they ought to have positions of responsibility, and they didn't get them. And they became bitter and left. One person, it was reported to me many years ago, was asked to go to another assignment, and they refused and said, "I've worked my way up this far, and I'm not going to do it," and left the work. Today, that person is divorced. You know, something's awry in the thinking. I remember one wife who pleaded that her husband ought to be a state director and was very upset that he was not selected to be one. Now, our structure in the Navigators, and because this is a Nav group and you're familiar enough with Navigator things, I think I'd like to just take the opportunity to discuss some issues. Our structure tends to encourage some excesses of both ambition and authority. We've got a history that can do that. Because in the Navigators, there is a sense of levels of responsibility and authority. That in itself is not wrong. There is no biblical restriction for having a particular structure. The problem comes about when our structure works against us and encourages the issue of illegitimate ambition. And that's a very difficult one to deal with. It's interesting. We always want top people, uncommon people, gifted people, but we tend to have in the past to want to put them through sort of a ringer or sort of a process where we purposely, so to speak, humble them and not allow them to use their abilities. And it's a mix. I don't know the answer to this. We rarely bring in a person into the NAVs and promote them very fast. And if you want to even use the word promotion, I don't like the word promotion. It does not appeal to me, but yet it's around. I recently was in a situation where someone had been appointed in a foreign country to a position of responsibility. I'm trying to be very vague on this. And a letter was sent congratulating them. And the person couldn't even figure it out. What's to be congratulated? He didn't even think of it as being a position. He was just going to do a task. And the fact that someone who thought structurally wrote a letter of congratulations on his new promotion didn't even fit with his thinking. He just couldn't even understand why anybody would even think that way. But we still have the problem. We've got to think it through. See, in the Christian community, we tend to reward the results of ambition, and we exalt the successful. We give titles, even in the Navigators, and we give positions. And much of that tends to encourage ambition. It could. It's really strange in the Christian community that we all like to be around people who are presidents of corporations, who have garnered wealth, who have been successful, but you watch out for that young person in his 20s who's around our ministry who has that kind of drive, and we clobber them on the head and tell them that they ought not to do that. Now, that's a problem for us. I'm just trying to surface what I see as a dilemma in our system, because that person, to get to that position, has paid a great price in terms of time and effort, and very likely they haven't done all that well in the ministry. And very likely they may have struggled spiritually and had to get that in gear. And very often a person in his 40s and 50s who's been highly successful, and we exalt them in the Christian environment and put them up and say, boy, I know vice president of this, and I know this guy, and he's done this. We never ask the question, how'd he get there? Was it by honest means? Was it ethical? Was he walking with God in the process? And would we emulate the way that he got there to our other people? I've often seen around in various ministries where when a person really wanted to accomplish something, there's a tendency on our part to put them down and to restrict them and to not want them because the cost is very high. I have a guy out of our ministry at Purdue who is just a minor genius, and he's been around our ministries for some while. And he is really doing well, but it's been a struggle for him, and he's got certain gifts. Well, today, he has finally finished both his PhD in electrical engineering and his MD degree, going into to significant research in the area that will combine, and they're very unusual to find one with that combination. And he's going into the Air Force just within the next month or so, I believe, or month or two, and he will go in as a major. Well, it's cost him a great deal to get to that situation, and I suppose he's gone through some struggles out in the areas. But you know, you don't become something without a certain cost. And some of us have to recognize that whatever we're going to develop in is going to cause some restrictions for periods of time. Perhaps in ministry. I hope never in the area of our personal walk with God. But it's a dilemma. I wish I knew how to answer that particular question and how to solve it. I just want to raise this question so that you understand that I see some rather unusual anomalies within the Navigators. And I don't mean to be critical of us. I am part of it. But what I want us to understand is that I want us to understand that we don't always operate consistently. I guess that's what I'm saying. We always have conflicting goals. And it comes back to each one of us and our personal responsibility as to why we are doing what we are doing. And I could give you many, many illustrations of where there have been various struggles with what a person did and what he chose to do as opposed to giving 20 hours a week to the ministry. And it's caused a great deal of conflict. But later on, if the person is led by God, he may have a lifelong ministry. And somehow we've got to take the long view of the way we're going for the future. See, I know for myself that even though I didn't want to do some of the things that I did in my own career, that there are certain abilities that I have today that I'm not sure ever would have been developed without going through what I went through. I don't know. God could have done it in a different way. But the fact is, with the world beating on my head and putting me under certain pressures, I'm a different person than I would have been through another process. That's a long introduction to this particular subject, but I wanted to bring out the emotional traumas that I recognize in the Christian community and some of our inconsistencies in the way we view the issue of ambition. Now, there's one other dilemma, and I honestly do not know how to face this one. That is, if I were in Boeing Aircraft Company, or I were still on active duty in the Air Force, I would have absolutely no problem striving for promotion, striving for accomplishment, doing things well, and so forth. But when we're in the Christian community, that is not a legitimate thing to strive for. Well, is that an inconsistency? You know, is there position? Should there be? Well, those are hard questions. And rather than trying to give an answer, I have an opinion, incidentally. As my wife tells me and my kids, I don't ever have anything I don't have an opinion on. So, because I have thought through those things, especially since I am in a position of responsibility in the Navigators, I've tried to wrestle with the question, do I deserve to be there? And the answer is clearly no. Do I deserve to stay there? It's clearly no. But see, there may be an, you have to wrestle with your ambition and pride in the whole process. Well, before I wax too philosophical, let me get to some specific things with you. Let's define ambition. Ambition, by definition, this is out of the dictionary. It's a strong desire to gain a particular objective, specifically a drive to succeed or to gain fame, power, wealth, etc. It is the objective strongly desired. Okay, a strong desire to gain a particular objective, specifically a drive to succeed or to gain fame, power, wealth, etc. Or the objective strongly desired. Now, I would like to give you the bottom line on what I'm going to try to communicate to you today. I would like to ask the question, is ambition good or bad? Okay, the bottom question I believe is this. Ambition is neither good nor bad, but it is neutral. Now, let me give you some illustrations. Okay, is hunger bad? Is it? No. But what about gluttony? Okay, gluttony is an extreme of hunger. Okay, is desire wrong? Okay, but then desire moves into craving for something, and then it's wrong. Okay, how about love? Is love wrong? No, but when love moves to lust, then it becomes wrong, right? Did you see what I mean by that? Okay, what about ambition? Well, I am proposing to you that ambition is not wrong, but when it moves to the issue of selfishness and pride, then ambition becomes wrong. For instance, Paul said this in Philippians 3:10, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Paul was a man of ambition. Paul had goals. Paul said, I've been called to the Gentiles, and he's going to go, and those people in Jerusalem aren't going to keep me from it. You know, Paul was a goal-oriented person, and he had an ambition. And in one place, he said, well, am I boasting too much? You know, am I boasting in what God has given me? Okay, so I would say that the ambition is a matter of two things. One, its validity is a matter of whether the goal is righteous. Okay, what is the goal of the ambition? Okay, now, let's just say the goal is to, let's say, to have responsibility for developing a certain product in a company because you have the ability to do it. Good goal. That's not a bad goal. It's a right goal, it's a good product, and etc. Or let's suppose the goal would be to lead people to Christ and disciple them. Now, all of us would say, great goal. And that's my ambition. Now, the second thing that has to relate to the goal is your motives in reaching that goal. Okay, now just take the one on discipling and evangelism. Now, the goal is good, but what if your motive is so that I'll be known as the great evangelist? Or I want people to recognize me of what a good discipler I am. Or if the goal in being head of that product is I want people to look up to me. Do you see what I mean by the motive that underlies the goal? You can have a right goal and a wrong motive. You can have a wrong goal and a right motive. You need both of those to make the ambition valid. Now you say, okay, Jerry, I agree with you. That's theory. But now, that doesn't answer my questions. So let's talk first about illegitimate ambition. These are things that I believe the Bible teaches are issues that are illegitimate. And I could say sin, but I'll just say illegitimate for the motion. One is serving your own ego. Jeremiah 45:5 that I quoted earlier. But you, are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them. I believe God has no place for the Christian on an ego trip. Someone has said that an egotist is not a man who thinks too highly of himself, but one who thinks too little of other people. Ego is always comparative. I am better than someone else. I read a little account that says that there are two types of people in the world. There are those that come into a room and they say, "Here I am." And then there are those who come in and say, "Ah, there you are." Have you ever sensed that? How a person views themselves in that regard? And see, serving your own ego is not right. I believe that ambition focused on personal ego will never have God's blessing. You know, Saul was jealous of David's success, and God removed the kingdom from him. Not just for that, for many other things. The next thing is that a desire for position and power, or a motive for position and power, is wrong. Matthew 20, 25 and 26. Matthew 20, 25 and 26. Memorize it, but when I'm speaking and try to quote verses, I always goof myself up. So, but Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them." He says, "It is not so among you, but whoever wishes to be great among you shall be your servant." And I like the phrase, "But it shall not be so among you." Now, I believe a grasping for power and position just simply has in it the seeds of death. Now let's apply this to the Christian community. Yes? Yes, that I believe it does. It has to do with two things: what you want to use it for, but more particularly why you want it. It's the motive. And I use the Matthew 20 passage, see, to exercise authority. See, the great men exercise authority over them. I think all of us have seen people in positions of leadership who misuse the power and authority. And I could take this to an extreme. See, I think a person could say, "You know, I could do that job well and strive to get it." Now, in the Christian community, I would like to just make an observation that I believe we serve, and that I think our brothers and sisters need to basically select what we ought to do. And that has a primary controlling fact in the Christian community, not so much a striving for it. I think there are people of great ability that can do certain jobs, but it is rarely great ability that gets a job done. It is more than that. It has to do with Christian character along with ability, and the ability that is needed for a right time. Many of us, if you've been around the Navigators for very long, you will see people who have been in positions of authority and responsibility and now are not. I believe that is very common and is right. There is a period of time and a period of contribution, and we ought not to think that we deserve to have any particular task or position. Someone has always said there's always room for a servant. It's not easy to, quote, move downward in a positional thing, but I believe that God regularly will do it. And we just have to recognize what our basic motive is. So we need to be careful that the motive is not position and power. The other thing is there is a bad motive, or an illegitimate motive, is the desire to control others. By the way, let me just give you one other quote. There's a great quote by Henry Ford. Henry Ford says, "You know, the question of who ought to be boss is a little bit like asking the question, who ought to sing tenor in the quartet?" He says, "Obviously the person who can sing tenor." See, it becomes obvious many times that God has gifted someone. Now, just a thought on this. If we will concentrate on contribution and not position, then I believe that will solve most of the problems of wanting power.
The verse in 1 Timothy 3:1 where it talks about desiring to be an elder.
Yes, that's a good verse.
Yeah, I'm just trying to equate that to your statement in terms of letting others put you in a position that seems somewhat contradictory.
Well, the 1 Timothy says it is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. And I put my emphasis on that last phrase, that the desire is focused on the work, not the position, and to do the task. And then it gives, of course, a list of qualifications. And I think that is fine. I feel that every believer ought to desire to be in spiritual leadership with people, not necessarily positional, but just by his maturity and to meet those qualifications. Such as they become older, they will be, in fact, leaders in the body of Christ. And so that the desire is to do the work, not so much to have the position. That's what the way I would think of it, Carl. That's my interpretation of that particular verse. I've got a quote, and if I can find it, I will read it to you. Yeah. This has to do with grasping. It's by Howard Butt in a book called The Velvet Cover Brick. He says, presumption clutches for leadership too fast. Despair shrinks from leadership it already has. And you have to kind of think on that just a bit. Presumption clutches for leadership too fast, and despair shrinks from leadership it already has. Okay, let's talk about this desire to control others, which I think is a real problem. You see, in Matthew 20:25, it says, the rulers of the Gentile lord it over them and exercise authority. Now, the world's pattern is to control people for personal goals. To control people for personal goals. Now, I think all of us have an inner urge, I know I do, to change people's thinking. You know, every conversation that I enter into, I mean, I'm doing it right now. See, I'm trying to change some thinking, perhaps. You get in a conversation. We're always in that goal, that thing. We all have a desire, inner, perhaps not recognized always, to manipulate people. To get them to both see our way of thinking and to do our way. And to control others rather than to influence. It's just the nature of man. Even David tried to manipulate circumstances with Uriah, the Hittite. Even a godly man can fall in to the problem. And I think in the NAVs we have a tendency to play Holy Spirit at times in people's lives. And one of the greatest things we can do for some people is to refuse to make decisions for them. I can remember many situations when I've been leading ministries where I really wanted people to do something. You know, I wanted them to go to a conference or to do this or to do that. And I would just have to hold myself back to not use my skills in debating to convince them that they ought to do something, but rather to back off and let God give them leading. I remember a guy in one of our ministries, a very sharp fellow who's now on staff with the Navigators and a missionary with us, that I was, for some pride purposes, I believe, wanted a bunch of people out to a meeting. Now, none of you ever have problems with that, I'm sure. But we really put the screws on some people to make sure they came. This guy was a rather serious student, and he was going to study. And somehow we really put the B on him, and I got home, and God just spoke to me and said, that's wrong. So I called him back, and I said, listen, forget everything I said. And if you feel that God wants you to come, fine. And if not, don't come at all. He didn't come to that particular meeting. We have got to be willing to allow people to make decisions before God rather than to exert control over their lives. Now, just a thought. There is a difference in controlling people's persons and controlling people's work. Do you see the difference? Okay. I cannot control you and how you think, the way you run your personal life, and some of those decisions. But within an employment, in an organization or a task, then I do, if I am a supervisor, I do have a responsibility to control certain aspects of how you work and what you do. Now that, so control is not bad, but the reasons for the control, I ought not to want to control you, even in the context of your work, because of a sense of inner power that I have to say, no, don't do this, and yes, do that. So that's an illegitimate ambition. The other ambition that I think is wrong is money. I don't believe that money and a motive to be rich should be a factor. Proverbs 23, 4, and 5 is a passage you can jot down. Proverbs 23, 4, and 5. Ecclesiastes 5, 10. Ecclesiastes 5, 10. And 1 Timothy 6, 10. Now, by the way, the idea of making a lot of money is not wrong. The question is why. It always goes back to a motive. And I believe the issue of materialism is one that all of us have to grapple with. I believe it's easy, too easy to say that if I am obeying God, then He is bound to bless me materially. That's called prosperity theology. And I believe that's a wrong application of Scripture. All you have to do is travel into Asia, into the third world a little bit, and to realize there are godly people who are very poor and are never going to be wealthy. In fact, there are godly people who are going to be hungry. And I believe God will protect them. I think there's a scriptural promise on that. So the focus on just getting money, I believe, is wrong. Now, just because we happen to be with the navigators doesn't change them. You know, wanting to have wealth, wanting to have enough money to live. But the motive, the ambition just to have money, I believe, is wrong. And then finally, I believe we need to guard the issue of competition. Philippians 2:3, never act from motives of personal rivalry or personal vanity. That's the Phillips translation of Philippians 2:3. Now, frankly, competition is one of the greatest motivators in humanity. I mean, it's obvious that I'm a competitive person. I know it in my own heart, and most men are competitive. Adam Smith, in a book called The Money Game, he said you could take away all the trophies and substitute plastic heads or whale's teeth, and as long as there is a way to score, they'll play. I like games where you keep score. I prefer handball instead of running. And part of the issue is you win and you lose. Competition in and of itself is not bad. I think a competitive posture in business is a very good one. I believe that it is the way life is. And I don't see anything in the Bible that counters it. But I believe that we have to be careful how we personally handle the issue of competition. I believe we need to compete against our own personal standards, not so much against other people. The issue is not, is competition good, but how do I view the people with whom I am in competition? Is it a cutthroat thing? Do I undermine them? For instance, I've talked to people who are very competitive, and people hate them. And a real estate guy I talked to once, and I said, well, do you ever help people? Do you ever give other people leads? Do you ever share your secrets of how you're able to sell so well? Well, he hadn't thought of that. See, so just the fact that we have a good competitive edge is not a problem in and of itself. But when I do competition to crush the other person, to beat them out, to put them down, that's where the competition becomes illegitimate.